Now is the turn of our dear Mrs. Nakhchavani.
As I was listening to each group, I got more and more excited. I want to tell you something. When we get up here and speak about 10-year crusade and the excitement of the 10-year crusade, the idea is not to dampen your enthusiasm in present. It's just the opposite. I want to tell you what I loved about the culture and the folklore of old Iran. I don't know whether it exists anymore, I don't know. But they had a custom. When, for example, the wrestlers were wrestling, there was a man who was sitting and singing of the glories of the past in Iran. How they fought and what great heroes they had. What was the purpose of it? Was to make the ones who were wrestling more powerful, do better. When a man was building a wall, he was sitting up there with the bricks, one brick after another. He was singing of the beauty of paradise. Why? To make the ones, the laborers who were working, more excited and work. Now, what I am telling you about the stories is really just that. To bring back to you a period which has already passed. And that to excite you so that you do also to give as much as you can of your efforts and your times to your own present work. This world order of Baha'u'llah, how many times Shoghi Effendi refers to it as building the world order? Just one of the groups just mentioned that right now. It is building. I don't know how many of you have been from the beginning to the end of a construction work. It goes through different stages. There are periods of this building which you don't see anything. For example, the time that the drawing is made and the plan is made, we don't see much. Or the time that they are going and buying the land or even digging the foundation, it's not so much excitement, you know, for the onlookers, for the owners. Then there are periods during this building that the excitement is there. Now, I think 10-year crusade was one of those periods when Shoghi Effendi, for the first time now, he was bringing up the walls. Now, suddenly you looked and you could see with your own eyes how this house is going to look. This is the boundary of this wall, and this is there, and inside there is this corridor, and there. The building is not finished, but at least you are going to see, you are looking at something which will one day finish. When I look at this building now, to my mind, maybe I'm wrong, I see it, we have reached the point that we are doing a lot of detail work now in this building. We are putting the electricity in the wall. We are putting the heating system in the house. It's a very essential part. We know that eventually we have been shown by the architect what a beautiful edifice it's going to be. So that in whichever period of this building we are sure that unless we give hand to it, unless we put our shoulders to it, it's not going to finish. So we are all really, as one of you said, participating in bringing up and completing this wonderful, beautiful structure that Baha'u'llah has given to mankind. I told you yesterday about the 2-year plan in Africa. I mentioned the name of Claire Gong. Last night when I went to bed, I realized I didn't finish her. I just brought her to Tanzania and I left her there. This little woman, after 2 years that was in Tanzania, when the 10-year crusade started, she left her job. She was a girl, a woman who had no means, you know. She didn't have a lot of bank account to move where she wanted to go. She would work for a little bit. She would save her money. And then when the opportunity came and she realized there is a crusade now and she can do more, she took her saving and left Tanzania and became a Knight of Baha'u'llah for a country that in those days was called Southern Rhodesia. Today we call it Zimbabwe. She, with many others, became Knights of Baha'u'llah for that country. And then she looked around after a year or two and she saw too many pioneers. She couldn't stand that. She thought, well, they have enough. They don't need me. She again uprooted herself and came back to East Africa. And eventually she ended in Uganda. Eventually she was able to do what was the desire of her heart from very young age. And that was to build and own a little school for young children, all of her own. And she was able eventually to do this. And this little woman became older and older, and she did not have very good health. And she remained in her post at the time that practically all the other pioneers were driven away from Uganda. It was the years, the 10 years of terrible time in Uganda. So much unrest, so much insecurity. They told us the story of Claire. They said one night in the middle of the night or middle of the day, I don't remember when it was, one of her workers, one of the young women, African women who was working for her, came and called her and said, Auntie Claire, come. People are attacking the school, the mob coming towards the school. It was the period that there was a lot of unrest in Uganda. So many thousands and upon thousands of people were murdered. The houses were looted. So this mob was coming, attacking the school of Claire. They said she went and stood outside. She had a balcony on her second floor, and she was very little. And to the end of her life, she spoke English with a very thick German accent. She went and stood on her balcony, opened her arms. Now the mob with sticks and machetes and whatever they had were going to come to the house and loot it. She stood there and looked at these people and screamed at them. She said, "What are you doing? I am Auntie Claire. This is my school. Go away." They said the people just stood, you know, dumb. Looked at her and amongst themselves they started talking. They turned around and left her. She had that kind of a courage, this little woman. And when 3 years ago, Ali and I went for the 50th anniversary of the arrival of the faith in Uganda, who do you think spoke of Auntie Claire? The Ministry of what was he? Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Social Affairs. He was representing the president. He was representing the government of Uganda at this celebration. And he told us that he knew of the Baha'i faith because he was a little boy in the school of Auntie Claire. Practically everybody of any importance had gone through this nursery school of Auntie Claire. And they were all knew about it. When my father passed away, on the day of his funeral, there were quite a number of non-Baha'is present, and we had no idea who they were. And we heard from them that these were parents of many of the children at Claire's school. And they said that our children were coming home for the past 1 week and telling us that this morning we had a prayer for Mr. Banani. My father was in coma for a few days. And during all these days, she would get every morning her children to have a prayer, and she would mention the name who they are praying for. And so the children would go and tell their parents. And when in the radio it was announced that Mr. Banani had passed away and such and such a day is his funeral, many of these people just came to the funeral because of what they had heard from their children through Claire. She was, I mention her because she was very much loved by all of us. She was really one of the heroines of the faith during this crusade. Now, this was in 1952 we were, when my parents had gone to the Holy Land, and I told you about the prayers of Shoghi Effendi and the effect of it that brought Mr. Olinga into the faith. Now, something very special happened during that pilgrimage. It was at the last day of their pilgrimage when they went in the presence of the beloved guardian to say goodbye to him, that the beloved guardian told my father that he had appointed him as the hand of the cause for the continent of Africa. This devastated my father. He was a very, by nature, innately, he was a very humble man. He could not accept this, and with all the love and the reverence that he had for Shoghi Effendi, after all he was a businessman, so he started bargaining. He was dumbfounded, and he told Shoghi Effendi, "But Shoghi Effendi, why? I haven't done anything. I'm not a teacher. I am not a person who do, you know, things. I have not traveled. Please, Shoghi Effendi, it's not me." And Shoghi Effendi assured him that it was him that he had spoken of. That it was him that he had chosen to be the hand of the cause for Africa. And so the first 5 years of the crusade, he was the only hand of the cause in Africa. And it made, as the result of it, it made his home really the heart and the center of all activities in Africa. Every message from the Holy Land, from the beloved guardian, would come to him, and then from there he had to send it to the different countries of Africa, individuals or groups. His home was the place where people like Bill Sears and John Robarts and the whole lot of them, important Baha'is who came to Africa, came through this house and went to their posts. It was a very exciting home. In those days, everything came from Holy Land by cable. And the cables came in the briefcase of a little African worker on a bicycle. He would bicycle from the post office and come to the homes and deliver cables. This bicycle fellow sometimes would come to the house 10 times a day. And you could hear the bicycle moving, coming up the gravel, and you knew that a cable has come. These cables, it was very much like you have the heart and the arteries. And this main artery from the heart was from Haifa to Kampala, Uganda. And then from there it would spread to the rest of the body of Africa. It was very, very exciting days. So most of the pioneers passing, they would come through there. It all, the excitement was that in that beginning of that crusade, when, as Ali was mentioning today, Shoghi Effendi asked the Baha'is of Uganda, this was now The holy year began in October of 1952, and it's going to the 1953. During this holy year, Shoghi Effendi asked the Baha'is of Uganda to move to also pioneer and go and open new territories. During this holy year, also I had the privilege of going and meeting the beloved guardian. I went on pilgrimage in the April Rizwan of 1953. It was one of the most exciting times. So many times, Ruhi Khanum and other hands of the cause in Haifa would tell me and my sister-in-law, who had come from Tanzania, we went together, they would tell us how fortunate you are, because Shoghi Effendi had not been so happy for years. Every day that he would meet with the pilgrims, he had news to give us. And his news were the cables he had received from all the corners of the world, where the pioneers had just arrived, or a local assembly had just been formed. I remember one day he said to us, he said, I had a message today that the local assembly has been formed in Kuching. I always thought I was very good at geography. I had no idea where Kuching was. And we must have looked dumb, because he looked at me and he said, do you know where Kuching is? I said, no, beloved guardian, I don't. And then he told us where it was. He was very excited. One day he said, he looked at me and he said, do you know how many local assemblies were formed in Uganda? I said, no, beloved guardian, I don't. Because when I was leaving Uganda, nobody knew. Ali had gone to the villages. They were hoping for some local assemblies, but nobody knew how many. Remember, we had just one in Kampala the year before. And now this year, we knew that it's going to be some, but we didn't know how many. I said, no, I don't know how many, beloved guardian. He roared with laughter. That was one of the greatest joy of my life, to hear that ringing laughter of Shoghi Effendi. He laughed and he said, you come from Uganda and I have to give you the news? And then he said, there are 13 local assemblies formed. From one jump to 13. You can imagine the excitement of Shoghi Effendi. That, from that time period that the first local assembly was formed until this 10-year crusade began, also many wonderful things happened in Uganda. Mr. and Mrs. Collison, with one young man, an African Baha'i who was a very distinguished and extraordinary young man. His name was Donduzu Chisiza. He came from Malawi. He was a highly intelligent person. And in his youth, from very early youth, he was one of those freedom fighters of Africa. He had escaped from his own country because they were after him. And he had come to Uganda specially because in the only private school which was owned and run by an African was in Uganda in those days, in East Africa. And so many of these students, out of their own nationalism and their own love of Africa, they had come to this school because they didn't want to go either to the mission schools or to the colonial government school. So this school was a kind of a hot house of many of these hot-headed young Africans who were really fighting for the freedom of their own country. And Donduzu was one of them, and he was a leader of them. And he became a Baha'i, and he became a very distinguished Baha'i. And he became a Knight of Baha'u'llah because he went with Mr. and Mrs. Collison and opened Rwanda-Urundi. Now, Rwanda-Urundi was one country in those days. Now it is divided into two. So this was the first excitement. Uganda sent out three nights of Baha'u'llah to the neighboring country. Then, from then on, it was all fantastic things. When I came back from the pilgrimage, something very interesting happened during my pilgrimage. First of all, I should be ashamed, but I'm going to tell you what kind of a pioneer I was, so that you will be very encouraged of what wonderful young people you are. I had gone to Uganda. I was a pioneer. I was very proud to be, pioneering, but I had my very, very terrible limitations. I had never put my foot out of Kampala. I was afraid to go to the villages. I didn't know what kind of places they are. It all started right after this first formation of the first local assembly in Uganda, when Inakulinga had 3 weeks vacation. He went home to his own village, and after 3 weeks he came back to Kampala, and he brought the news that not only his family, but many of his friends, hundreds of people, are very interested in the faith, but nobody listens to him. He's one of them, he's their own child. Nobody is going to take his word. And they told him that you go, send the white man who taught you this to come here and tell us. He came to Kampala and he came to Ali and he said, Ali, you have to go. They wanted both Ali and Philip, but Philip was working. You see, he was not as free as Ali was. He said, Ali, you have to go. There are people waiting and ready, but they won't listen to me. They want to see you. So Ali went on several weeks away, and he came back with this harvest, the first harvest of many, many believers. Within 1 year from 5-6 new Baha'is, suddenly we had 200 Baha'is. It was just something unbelievable. It's as if it burst open, a dam broke. And of course, from there, it just went like wildfire. They would themselves, people from one village to another, from east and west, and it just spread. So Uganda had just opened like anything, and it had made Shoghi Effendi very happy. So this was the thing. Now, Ali would come back from these trips and from the villages, and I would very timidly ask, well, where did you sleep? What? How was it? Did they have a bathroom? Did they? What was the food like? And he knew what a fuss pot I was. And I had this very awful thing in me from my childhood. I hated to travel because I didn't like to sleep in strange beds and put my head on a strange pillow and so on. So he would tell me, oh, it was very good, but it's not for you. There's plenty of work here in Kampala. Who's going to do it? You stay here and you take care of the work in Kampala. He says, villages are not for you. And I didn't show much eagerness to go. Especially that when he came back very soon, he would come back always with malaria and always with dysentery and always with all the trouble. So I thought it was a wonderful division of labor. I was quite complacent. It was fine. Then I went to Haifa. One day we were sitting, the custom was in those days, in the days of Shoghi Effendi, the Oriental pilgrims, men and women, were separated. So in the afternoons, men would go to the shrine of the Bab, where Shoghi Effendi would join them, and they would walk around with Shoghi Effendi and go into the shrine and have prayers. And during that period, women would come to Abdul Baha's house, and we had tea with Ruhi Khan. In one of these afternoons, Ruhi Khanum, suddenly, I suppose, and afterwards when I knew Ruhi Khanum, I could imagine why she said it, but that day I didn't. She suddenly looked at me and she said, "You know, Violet, you remind me of my cousin." You know, Ruhi Khanum was a very Western look, blonde and very fair skin. I couldn't imagine she had a cousin who looked like me, you see. And then she explained. She said, "You see, my cousin, also like you, my cousin has a mother who is a very dynamic person and very good teacher, and she always hides behind her mother. She doesn't do anything by herself. And you are the same. You have a father who is the hand of the cause. Your husband is such a wonderful teacher, and he goes forward and does this. You hide behind them. Come out. Do something." "Do what? You know, I'm just sitting." And she suddenly had this. Ruhi Khanum was fantastic, I tell you. If there was anybody who had imagination, it was Ruhi Khanum. So she thought a little bit. She said, "You know what you can do? Go on a trip by yourself to the Congo." There is a Baha'i family there, Mr. and Mrs. Vahdat. He is Persian, his wife is Belgian, and they are all alone. There is nobody in this whole big country of the Congo. Why don't you go and visit them and tell them about your pilgrimage and about these beautiful gardens and everything, and encourage them and cheer them up? And I remember sitting there and listening this. Of course, it was wonderful for me, you know, to be addressed like this by Ruhi Khanum, made me very happy. But in the same time, I remember I had that funny feeling. I said, "How sweet she is. You know, she's encouraging me. She's so sweet." Half an hour later, the beloved guardian had come, and all the ladies went in his presence, and he was talking about, as I say, all the victories of the 10-year plan. He was so happy. These were really, most of the time, these were the talks. And then there was a lull. He had finished. And lo and behold, Ruhi Khanum turned to him and said, "Shoghi Effendi, today I suggested to Violet to go to the Congo." I have been many, many times. I have gone into that room of the reception room of Abdul Baha when we were in the presence of Shoghi Effendi. I have stood at that door and I have looked at that chair and I have remembered that day. At that moment when Ruhi Khanum started talking, I thought I had died. I thought to myself, now, it is one thing for Ruhi Khanum to encourage you, but to come and say to Shoghi Effendi, now, what's going to happen, you see? And Shoghi Effendi listened and very graciously looked at me and he said, "If you can do it, it would be very good." Well, it was a stamp. I remember that night I was really, I didn't know what to do. And I eventually, with all my sleeplessness, and now, I thought, well, I have to go home and tell Ali. He has to do this for me, you know. This was one. And then on the last day, when we were in the presence of the beloved guardian, and you know, it's no matter how many days you were there, it didn't matter how often you saw him. I think that last day for every one of the pilgrims, to know that it's the last day that they are going to see that beloved of their hearts, it's a wrenching. You are as if they are right there taking your soul out of your body. It is very hard, very, very sad occasion. And then in that day, he said to me, "When you go back to Uganda, you go and visit the Baha'is and tell them about the holy places and give my love to every one of the Baha'is. I heard this because I was just myself so upset and half crying, and just it didn't occur to me until I was on the plane and I was reliving and rehearing the words, and it suddenly shook me to go and see the Baha'is. These Baha'is are all in the villages. We have 10 Baha'is in Kampala. The rest of them are scattered. How am I going to do that? I have to tell Ali to go. And arrived in Kampala. We didn't sleep that night because he wanted me to repeat and repeat and repeat every day what was happening and what Shoghi Effendi said. And when I told him about this, and I said, Ali, you have to, this is what Shoghi Effendi said. And Ali very calmly told me, did he say that I should go? I said, no, but you know I can't go. He said, no, this is to you. And that was my first venture outside the home and the villages. And Inakulinga was the period that Inak had lost his job and he had nothing to do. So he said, I'll go with you and I'll translate for you. And because my parents were traveling and Bahia was very little, Ali said, okay, I'm going to stay home with Bahia, you go. And they were an American couple, new pioneers. They offered to drive me, and then we set off. And we went for 3 weeks all over Uganda and to every single village where there was even one Baha'i, to see the individual Baha'is, to tell them about the faith. I remember night after night when I was going to sleep, how in my prayers I weep and I say how foolish I was. What's the matter with me? I had lost one whole year to come out here. What was I afraid of? It was really heaven. I remember so many wonderful things that happened during that trip. One of it was we went very far north to the almost furthest village at that time to see there was one old woman who was the heart and soul of that area. There were several Baha'is there, but she was really the heart of the community. And no woman until then had gone there. None of the pioneer women had been there. So when the car arrived and she saw that in this car there were two pioneer women, she became so excited and she started dancing and going around. And as she was from all around her yard, she was greeting us. She was also chasing her biggest rooster. She wanted to cook this for very special guests. And she caught her rooster and right in front of us, cut the throat and prepared it and put it in the pot and started cooking it. I think we were in that village for an hour when she brought the dinner to serve. And of course, this poor cock was huge and was never cooked. I remember Alan Elston was given a leg of this chicken. He held it and he tried to bite. Nothing happened. He held it in his hand. He looked at me. He said, I'm afraid to put it down. It will run again. So that was the beginning of my love, really, for going in the villages and so on. Then comes now the other. Now go to the Congo. How to go to the Congo? We had no idea. Neither of us have been in the Congo. Most we had done, and we hadn't done it at that time yet. We hadn't even gone to see the Colossians. So we started making inquiries. How can we go to the Congo? At that time, Congo was very much a Belgian colony. And the Belgians were much harder on the people than the British were in Uganda. Maybe they were hard also in other places, but Uganda was a much freer place. Now, there were a lot of Greeks who were traders coming to East Africa. They would buy thing and go. So eventually somebody had this idea that one of these Greek traders can take me. Now remember, this was in 1953. I was only 25 years old, still young. And we had a Greek friend. He was our man who had a kind of a shop and had breads and cakes and things. So we went to Christo to see what he thought we should do with the Greek traders. He said, like, I have some friends. When they come here, they come to my home. Next time when they come, I'll call you. But he was very surprised. And he looked at Ali. He said, Ali, you would let her to go with one of the traders? He said, well, we will see. We are making inquiries. So one day, Christo called us and he said, oh, my friends have come. They are two truck drivers, traders, and they are here and they are tonight in my home. Come and meet them and talk with them. We went there and, you know, truck drivers all over the world are very much alike. They are huge people, very rough people, and these two were no exception. And we went there and Ali told him what we wanted. Wanted to see if you could take my wife from here, Kampala, and take him to Kamina in the middle of the Congo. I never forget the look of these two men. They looked at me. They looked at Ali. They said, are you crazy or something? They said, you know what you're asking? I said, you know us? No, we know Christo. I said, don't do it. This is dangerous. He said, if you're not afraid of us, be afraid of the Belgian government officer. They frightened us so much that we decided, for God's sake, we don't do something too foolish. But what to do? This coincided with the time that now Shoghi Effendi had asked the Africans to pioneer. We had 3 volunteers to pioneer. Ina Kolinga volunteered to go to Cameroon. Max Kanyarezi, a wonderful man that I want to specially speak about him because very little is said about him. He was a very exceptional man. He volunteered to go to the French Congo, what they call it, French West something or another.
Equatorial
Africa, and a young man who was going as to help Mr. Wahdat in the Congo. These 3 were the volunteers, and they wanted to know, and Ali was making inquiries how to send them to their post. It was not easy. So when we found that I couldn't go, we came to this conclusion that maybe we can combine these two together, that we can ourselves go, Ali would drive, I will go with him to meet the Wahdats and fulfill my obligation, and in the meantime, it's nothing. I mean, if we go as far as Kamina, we'll go to Cameroon. How much we knew of the map of Africa. Have you looked at it? We had no idea what we were going to do. We didn't know anything. And we offered to take these 3 darling pioneers and put them in their posts. What to do with this poor little 4-year-old child, because my parents were not there. That is when Bahia and her glass of orange juice came. So we arranged with the Yazdi family, who were by then in Nairobi. The arrangement was that we will put Bahia on a plane and send her to Nairobi, and she would stay with the Yazdis until we go. We will go 1 month. It's nothing. We'll go, and the end of the month we are back, and we will go and fetch it. I have 5 minutes. I'm not going to go into that because that trip is a big, big story. I'll just say the beginning of it, and then the rest of it for tomorrow. We got ourselves prepared. My poor father had just bought a brand new station wagon, so he wasn't there. We sent the word to him, would you permit us to use your car to just go, you know, next door and put these pioneers and come back? And what could he say? Said yes. So we had this car all fixed for the trip. We built, you know, something on the top so that we can put our luggage on it. We filled it with food. We are going, you know, it's not a joke, you know, 5 people going on a trip. And the day came, we left Uganda. We decided that it would be a very good route to leave Kampala and go on our way, see the Colisons, and spend the night with them, and then enter the Congo. We arrived in Bujumbura, and they had, the Colisons were such a wonderful people. They had a house, the only place they were able to get was an African house. And it was very, very, really very humble. And they were living, they were the 3 of them, plus Donduzu was living with them. I try to remember how they fitted us. They did, anyway. We all stayed with them. And Mary, who was a very economical lady and wonderful lady, she had cooked for all of us that night a huge pot of beans. You know, these Americans love the beans. And then that's the main principal vegetable in that part of Africa, and she thought that it's very nourishing, it's a very good food, and it's very economical. So she had cooked a huge pot of beans. We all had beans for dinner. The next morning we got up early to leave. She gave me a big pot of what had remained of the beans. She said, listen, you have got these 4 huge men in the car. You have to feed them. Take this for lunch. So we took the beans. On the way, we stopped and had our beans for lunch. And we arrived around evening time in the city of Bukavu in the Congo. Bukavu was a beautiful city. Now, where to go? We didn't have money. None of us could afford the Belgian hotels at that time. Congo was unbelievably expensive compared to East Africa. It was very expensive. So we decided, none of us, neither we two nor the 3 friends in the car, we could not afford a hotel. Ali had a brilliant idea. He said, you know, the safest place for them, we will go and ask the police where they can spend the night. Went to the police station. Ali goes in to ask, we have these 3 young men with us, where can they stay? It was, you know, we were so completely different. The mentality of us was so different for the colonial powers in the mentality. It didn't occur to us that what the police is going to do with these 3 poor Africans who are from another country. So they came and looked at these 3 men, and the fellow said, it's easy, let them stay with us. They can stay with us. We give them a room, they spend the night here. We had no idea that they were going to lock them in. So we left these 3 in the police station, and we went ourselves outside the city, near the river, and we parked the car, and we decided to spend the night in the car, and in the morning go and pick them up and go. Well, with no idea that the beans out of the refrigerator for a whole 24 hours, it must have got fermented, and we didn't know. So the 2 of us had a terrible night. We had such a terrible dysentery, it was impossible. It just was terrible. So when the morning came, we said, we hope they are all right, you see, now. We had no idea why we were so sick. We went to the station. We got these poor three men, you know. They came in the car and they told us their story. They said when they locked them in, and a police with a gun outside the door, they had the dysentery. So they knock at the door, the policeman would open and say yes, and they say toilet. He would walk, one of them would come out, the police with a gun would walk behind them, take them outside to the lavatory, stand outside the door. When he finished, they'd bring him back in the room, lock the door. 2 minutes later, knock at the door. Till morning, these poor three men, continuously back and forth. And of course, as they were telling us the story, they said the police became very suspicious. They thought that they had a plan of escape. So in the morning when we went, they were relieved to come to the car, and the police was relieved to get rid of them. Do you know, to the end of his life, whenever Enoch would come to Haifa, it was enough for me to look at him and say, Enoch, would you like some beans for dinner? And he would roar with laughter. So you keep Bukavu. I'll tell the rest tomorrow.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Nakhchavani. Thank you for sharing all these stories. And especially, personally, I thank you because because you share also your weakness with us. And this gives us a lot of courage. Thank you so much.